The Playlist with Ben and Fiona.
I come from a family of very quiet people where not much is said and so much is like in those moments.
Welcome to The Playlist, where we talk about movies and TV shows that are worth your time. I'm Fiona Williams, and I manage our online coverage of movies and TV here at SBS, and I'm joined in person by my co-host, SBS and SBS Viceland channel manager. There's been some changes. Ben Nguyen. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Fee. Oh, my goodness. This is so strange to be here in person. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Nice to see you in the flesh.
Yeah, and it's almost a brand new Lunar New Year as well.
All of that.
It's an exciting time to be alive. I'm feeling positive about the New Year.
Well, look, I mean, it'd be weird if you weren't because we all couldn't wait to see the back of 2020. But yes, here we are. We thought we'd do an episode of this crazy podcast in the flesh. We've been Zooming for months now.
This feels very exciting. And, you know, what better way to do our first playlist of the year than taking a look at a brand new movie launching around the country next week called Minari. It's the story of a Korean migrant family attempting to start afresh in rural Arkansas, and it's attracting plenty of award season buzz. And Fiona, you speak with the film's writer-director Lee Isaac Chung, and we'll also think back on the year that was and what's exciting us for the year ahead.
That's a lot. Let's do it.
That's plenty. Let's get into it. So, Fee, I might jump into, you know, what have you been watching? Usually use that to kind of round out the show, but we're seeing each other in the flesh for the first time this year. And I happen to know that you spent a lot of the summer taking in screenings by the beach.
I did. Saw a lot of short films in January, February. Yeah, Flickerfest, good old Flickerfest. It was my first in-person festival for a while. I was helping judge the international features on that. So it was so good to be among people safely and watching all the shorts from around the world. So, yeah.
Sounds like a great way to spend the summer. And, you know, sort of I imagine there was other viewing opportunities across those warmer months?
Across the warmer months, yes. I did make it to the cinema a couple of times. First time freaked me out because people sat right behind me and I had to move and then someone went to sit.
Had to have words with them.
Look, yeah, I don't know. People, we need to be careful. So anyway, it was all fine, I hasten to add, but yeah. Can we keep distancing? I just want to say that. Yes, went to the cinema.
We are, despite being in the same room, we are at a decent distance apart from each other. I just want to clarify that point.
Quite right, yes. So, yeah, I went to the movies, saw Promising Young Woman.
Oh, yes, heard good things.
Yes, those things are true. well said. What else did I watch? I think that's the only time I was in a cinema. But other things on streaming services because that's kind of my habit now. What
yes.
about you?
Well, speaking of keeping safe distances, eager listeners will know that I was heading off to get married last time we did one of these episodes, and that fortunately all went ahead as planned. But I did return back to my home in Sydney just in time for a COVID outbreak and to be locked down. So didn't get out and about very much during that mandatory lockdown period, but I probably did what I feel like a lot of us have done, you know, in these past few months and probably a year, in that there was a lot of nostalgia rewatching that happened. So I do have to admit to a sort of a family binge screening, which is still ongoing, of Downton Abbey.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, reliving the roaring 20s.
Look, why not? There's no rhyme or reason to what people are binging at the moment. You do you. Where are you up to?
Don't want to give anything away for those who, but there may be a little bit of a gay conversion therapy storyline going on, which is actually a little bit confronting. Mm. But, you know, I have to say sort of between an 11-year-old and a 41-year-old, there's a lot of enjoyment being had by all.
Fun for all the family.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, 2020 was a very odd year, just sort of thinking back. You know, I think that in a way we probably were watching more of some content than we ever usually would, and yet we probably were seeing less of other things. We know a lot of movie releases got held back and pushed back. But, you know, overall, I feel like it was a pretty strong year for content. I went back and looked at some of our past playlist episodes for 2020 and just sort of want to throw at you some of the shows that we discussed. So Mrs. America, for me, that was a big highlight of the year. You know, a really great way to talk about, you know, a really pivotal moment in history with the women's movement and told from a number of different perspectives and different sides of the political debate.
Yeah.
Never Have I Ever was a fun show, revitalizing kind of teen comedy through a cultural lens. Normal People got people very excited for a sort of short while anyway.
Yeah.
Upload was a show which I had completely forgotten existed.
I just didn't have to rack my brains thinking of it. Yes.
But it was a good time, you know, a kind of take on that idea of literally uploading ourselves onto the cloud and our personalities existing after death. Bad Education, I think we both enjoyed. Yeah. Hugh Jackman, a take on the kind of corruption within the US school system. This is a long list, so, you know, feel free to kind of jump in at any point. I'll rattle off a few more. The Great, yeah. Love Life, Taskmaster, we all got very excited about. It's sort of, you know, that's a show that's been rolling out over a number of years, but we finally managed to launch it here on SBS Viceland.
I haven't stopped watching it. That was a big highlight of my summer, all the versions.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Speaking of my 11-year-old and also my 13-year-old, we did have a big time, both watching Taskmaster, but also as a Christmas present, the Taskmaster board game arrived. And I'll tell you what, that's good times had by all. Indian matchmaking in the reality dating space. Perry Mason, you know, very, very sort of gloomy HBO series.
Still haven't watched it.
Hungry Ghosts on SBS. Hillary, the documentary series, was an exciting moment for us here. The Good Fight, I think, had a terrific year despite the season being cut short by COVID. Schitt's Creek was a big milestone for the year, came to its final season, won all the awards possible and probably even some more than that.
Still got a few more to win, I think.
At the Emmys. Well, yeah, more
Golden
to come.
Golden Globes.
Yeah. So, and I feel like for a lot of people who maybe hadn't gotten on the Schitt's Creek bandwagon, you know, they're there now.
Yeah.
They're all aboard.
Yeah. And if for any reason you aren't listeners, yeah, some people tap out at season two thinking, oh, I mean, it's a nice little sitcom, but yeah, then it gets deeper. Yeah, do it. And I was putting off watching the final season because I didn't really want to say goodbye, but yeah, had a weekend away for my husband's birthday and just we've been to the whole thing. So it's great. And I'm sure it's going to be great on holding up to rewatch
in
the future too.
Yeah, no, it's a very joyous experience. You know, obviously it's just one of those shows where you come to love and adore these characters and you want to spend every waking moment you can with them. And so when the show wrapped up, I think that was met with very mixed feelings from those of us who were deeply involved with the Rose family. And The Queen's Gambit sort of was one of those sort of talked about shows. Apparently sort of a lot of chess sets got sold.
I do believe, yes. I've not watched it yet. that person.
I think it's fair to say for me, like it ran out of steam, you know, in a narrative sense. But I think it just was one of those shows that sort of landed in a quiet moment where people kind of just wanted what it had to offer. The Undoing was another show which seemed to land at a moment where people wanted what it had to offer, if only it was a better show.
Again, haven't watched it, but yeah, I heard the blowback.
And one more which we did have a chance to chat about, which was The Crown, which I don't know if it had its best ever season in 2020, but you could do a lot worse than hanging out with Charles and Diana as they fell apart at the seams.
Hold the popcorn, yes.
And more to come, obviously, with the next season where they'll all be recast. So we get Imelda Staunton stepping in to wear the pink matching ensembles.
and the literal crown.
Yeah, as Queen Elizabeth. Australian actress Elizabeth Debicki as stepping in as Diana, and they're talking about Dominic West as Prince Charles.
Huh. Okay. Elizabeth Debicki's good casting, I think.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of Diana on screen at the moment, has to be said. Yeah. Yeah, talk us through, Fee, you know, some of the shows that really stood out for you in 2020.
Look, listening to you speak a lot of those shows, I didn't watch it. I've not been watching a lot of what everyone else has been. So, yeah, look, just thinking 2020 is a bit of a blur because I was just watching anything and everything. So shout out to anything that was released, well, except for the things you just named. I May Destroy You, I was really impressed by, as were a lot of people. Caught that on Foxtel / Binge across the holidays, caught up and saw what everyone was raving about.
Yes, and what people are ranting about because Michaela Cole didn't get nominated in the Golden Globes.
Yeah. I mean, if we get started on what the Golden Globes left out, we'll be here all day, which I'm happy to do. Yeah, no, that was ridiculous.
Special sub-episode coming soon.
Yeah, right. Well, wait till the Golden Globes happen. Let me add them. But fantastic, and, you know, as the creator and the star and just what that does with, you know, a story of trauma and is incredible because it's funny and light but also has that depth as well. So great. And this wasn't meant to be a segue, but also The Great, which was really enjoyed. Caught up with The Flight Attendant over the holidays, which was great. I had a good time with that.
Yeah, I feel like it's sort of the show that people should have watched instead of The Undoing.
Ah, okay.
You know, in terms of a bit of a kind of murder mystery whodunit, sort of, you know, Page Turner style.
Very much so. I loved it. Right from the opening titles. I love a good opening title, but just that whimsical mystery noir kind of feel to the story of a flight attendant caught up in a murder scandal and espionage and, yeah, a lot of really complicated character, which I thought was great. I've never watched that show she's from, Kayla Cuoco.
Big Bang Theory.
That one, yes, thank you. Can't even remember it. But, yeah, so I'm not really familiar with her work, but thought she was excellent casting there. And I mentioned Taskmaster. That's just my eternal favourite at the moment. And big thanks to friend of the show, John Boehm.
Yes, yeah.
For putting me onto it.
Yeah, and you did mention a sort of slightly new role for me in terms of SBS Viceland. It is because friend of the show, John Boehm, has moved on to the greener pastures of Binge, shall we say. Greener as in dollar signs. Yes. I don't know if that's true. I'm sure that there were sort of more noble motivations than that. But, yes, if you happen to be flicking onto Viceland in the current period and something is not to your liking, I'm very sorry. I'm just sort of trying to keep my head above water in this transitional period, but we'll see what we can do.
We miss you, John.
Yeah, we do. Another few shows which we didn't get a chance to talk about last year on the show, but that meant something to me. The Mandalorian, it had its second season last year. I felt like it really found itself in terms of its ability to jump stylistically from episode to episode. I think that, you know, for fans of the Star Wars universe and sort of newcomers as well who, you know, maybe I think there was a lot of disappointment out there for the final Star Wars Skywalker film. And I think that The Mandalorian is a reminder of, you know, how that galaxy is a place for sort of really enjoyable storytelling that has so many nods to different cinema genres over time. City So Real was a documentary series that it was about the mayoral elections in Chicago. Terrific series, and also just want to mention America to Me, which is a couple of years older, but also made by the same director, Steve James, set in Chicago. Just really wonderful, observational series that get to the heart of what makes these societies click, really. And Small Axe was a series of five films by Steve McQueen, made for the BBC in the UK, out in Australia on Binge and BBC First on Foxtel. I think if you're a fan of his filmmaking, just both sort of by turns, beautiful and harrowing look at the experience of the black community within the UK And I think that a movie which we did talk about last year, The Trial of the Chicago Seven, there's an episode of Small Axe which I think is a real lesson in how actually to do a courtroom drama about people who are wrongfully accused of inciting a riot. I think that when you compare the two, the storylines are mm-hmm. very similar, but I think the end result, Steve McQueen's effort is clearly much superior.
Well, I don't doubt that. You know my thoughts on that film and on the director, Aaron Sorkin. May I just say, Golden Globe nominated director Aaron Sorkin, don't start me. Yeah.
Sadly for you, Fia, I feel like The Trial of Chicago 7 is destined to have a bit of an awards life.
Yeah, I've
so
lost
prepare
that
yourself
argument.
For that.
I'm hunkering down. Yeah.
And one more television series I just want to name check for 2020 as a personal favorite of mine, Survivor Winners at War. they did a season which was all past winners who had claimed the $1 million coming back to compete with one another, and one, Sandra, who's won twice in the past. And really, for me, there was sort of nothing more pleasurable on television than watching these sort of highly effective strategists go head to head. And particularly given that that show has had to call off production for the foreseeable future because of COVID risks. So, you know, I've just sort of had to hold on to that in the absence of new seasons.
Where does that spent energy go? My God.
What about movies, Fee, for 2020? I mean, we already know one of the movies you don't like.
Mm-hmm. That excited me. Well, happily, if listeners of the show might remember, I did flag a film that was coming up and I hoped would figure in awards season, and happily it is, One Night in Miami.
Yeah.
It is now available on Amazon Prime, so please go watch it. It's a beautiful film directed by Regina King, and she's getting director nominations all over the shop, happy to report. Sadly, she's up against Aaron Sorkin, but anyway. Yeah, no, that gorgeous film that's set in Miami on the night of, when he was known as Cassius Clay, that literally he changed his name the very next day. But, set in Malcolm X's motel room. And, it's just fantastic ensemble piece about powerful, influential black men, like leaders in their fields, having a conversation about how they're using their status and how some aren't, and how they can, should they be doing more right in the peak of the civil rights period. So such a good film and funny. It's just so warm and great. Also, I really enjoyed Promising Young Woman. These are all still available to watch. So, they bridge that 2020-2021 gap. Don't want to live in the past. They're out in the cinemas now. Go watch them. Promising Young Woman is getting a lot of attention because it's a revenge film from a woman's perspective, but kind of not really a bit of a thematic thread to I May Destroy You, but in a totally different handling. This, Liam Neeson makes a career out of doing revenge dramas. Like, he's a dad avenging the death of his daughter. But here, Kerry Mulligan is a woman out in the clubs avenging the date rapes that are epidemic. So, she tricks guys in clubs. Well, she doesn't trick them. They, she pretends to be drunk and incapacitated, really. So these kindly guys offer to help her home, and then, as is their want, they try and have their way with her, but she's very lucid and, makes it clear how she feels about that. It's really great. And much in the way this genre works with the revenge film, there are some leaps in logic you need to take to see it through. And there's one bit I didn't quite get on board with. There's one character that I thought, would that really happen? But also it doesn't matter. it's fine to have a big, ambitious revenge flick that, there's so much more that I enjoyed about it than that one thing. So, yeah, I thought it was great. So go see. And also one that's also actually coincidentally on Amazon Prime, The Sound of Metal, starring Riz Ahmed. He's in a metal band with his girlfriend. He's the drummer, and he suffers really significant hearing loss, and it's how he navigates hearing impairment. Fantastic film about disability. That flips how perceptions about how people with disability, he comes to realise how prejudiced he was, and it's just a fantastic performance by him. So do seek that one out. That was really great. I watched that one over the summer as well.
Oh, yeah. No, that sounds really good. I wanted to just name check a few movies from last year. Five Bloods, the
yes.
Spike Lee film about four friends who are all Vietnam vets revisiting the side of that conflict and manages to bundle a whole lot of different genres together.
Thank you for bringing that up because Delroy Lindo should be getting more notice for that role and he's not, and it's infuriating.
Yeah. On a lighter note, Palm Springs, I had a very good time with, and I think that, again, it was something, you know, it is a sort of Groundhog Day type story about a man and a woman who sort of get trapped in the cycle of reliving this wedding day over and over. Mm. And it did say something sort of unintentionally about the kind of loop that we all got stuck in last year. So I think that one's worth checking out if you haven't. I believe also on Amazon.
Yeah, look at us.
Jeez. Yeah.
What are we subscribed to?
On the feature documentary side, aka Jane Roe. Which I believe will be launching on the Star portion of Disney Plus, which rolls out later this month. And we spoke about this one last year, but it's The Extraordinary Story, which I had no idea about. I knew about the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court case, obviously, which has had lasting impacts and created some political divides in the US around abortion rights. But the story about the woman who was the kind of plaintiff in that case is a really extraordinary life story, which had to be told, and this film does it really well.
No, it really does, yeah.
And just one last one, I think that it's not really a movie, it's more of a concert film, if anything, but Hamilton, which launched on Disney Plus last year and by all accounts created a huge spike in uptake for the Disney Plus service, was a real revelation to me. I think that I was very aware of that musical. I'd never seen that musical. I've got my tickets booked to the Sydney production now. I think that I'll have very fond memories of that for 2020.
Excellent. Well, that's really good to hear. No, and that's also getting a bit of awards attention too because, I mean, the actual live performance in the US has already swept the Tonys and whatnot. Mm. But, as a recorded performance that's on a streaming service, it's also getting a little bit of love, which is a nice little footnote.
Yeah. Now, speaking of awards, Fee, a movie that is getting plenty of awards buzz this year, also sort of managed to pick up some of the big prizes from Sundance last year, is the American movie Minari, which I have just raced to the studio from an early morning screening of, but you've had the chance to see a couple of times. Talk us through this movie.
Yeah, true. I said I only went to the movies once. I apologise. I did see Minari in a cinema. There was a Sydney Film Festival's summer season, which was a great way to watch it. So I've since, seen it twice now, and I adore this movie, and it's getting some love and it should be getting some more, but we'll get to that. And look, this is the story of a Korean American family in the early 80s, very early 80s, trying to establish a farm in Arkansas. So it stars Steven Yeun, who, friend of the show, he spoke to us for Okja a couple of years ago, but I mean, probably best known still for The Walking Dead.
I mean, you know, Walking Dead was at one point the most watched show in the world, pretty much, and he was one of the original cast members from the very beginning. And I do actually feel like the point at which he left the show was a point at which a lot of the audience started to depart the show. Mm. But I think it's really interesting what he's done in kind of segueing his career into, you know, some more of these auteur-driven films.
Totally. See, I didn't watch The Walking Dead. So to me, he's only started with this amazing raft of films because it was Okja, but then Burning, which I'm going to spruik it. It's at SBS On Demand at the moment. I think I've mentioned it before, but it's a completely different role for him as a mysterious, sinister kind of a guy in this weird triangle of a movie. Anyway, I'm getting off the topic, but go watch Burning. So he plays the lead in this film, plays Jacob, and his wife in the film, Monica, is played by Yeri Han. There's the cutest kid who's ever been on screen called Alan Kim, who plays their son, David.
He's really, really good. It's really talented child actor.
Ridiculous, yeah. And his sister, who doesn't get much of a look in, but she gets enough to be the eye-rolling sister, whose name is Noelle Cho. And there is also a bit of a scene-stealing role by Korean, I don't know, doyen of Korean cinema, Yoo Jung-yoon, who is the grandmother who comes over from Korea, and she's the kooky grandma who doesn't bake cookies and hard swearing and, yeah, it's kind of looks at her bond with the young boy David, who is a movie version of director Lee Isaac Chung, who it's the story of his family. Lee Isaac Chung did grow up in rural America and his parents, you know, were trying to get a farm happening.
Well, this I was really interested in because, you know, I went into the screening this morning without any background knowledge of the story behind the film. So I wasn't sure whether it was a sort of autobiographical or, you know, biographical or if it was purely fictional. But so much of it felt so well observed and really authentic. You spoke about the grandma character, and she's a real revelation. You know, she comes in sort of, you know, maybe a third of the way through the film and comes and stays with them because she can no longer sort of care for herself back at home in Korea. And I feel like a lesser film might have painted her as the strict Korean traditionalist who and pitted her against, you know, these sort of migrant children who have tried to make a new life for themselves in the States. But, you know, she's getting into the Mountain Dew. She's getting into the wrestling. I think that that she really is a gorgeous character, and that bond that she builds with her grandson very slowly. You know, with a lot of humour, but that's sort of a real, really sort of sweet part of the film.
Yeah, I love it so much. Yeah, she, like he doesn't take to her immediately, let's say. Like he complains about having to share a room.
Yeah, exactly.
Complains she smells like Korea, I know. So it's the way that they find this unique relationship within this family. And the whole family is kind of doing that because, like Monica, the mother, she is not loving where they're living. Jacob has come first and sets up a house on in the middle of nowhere, let's face it, in a mobile home that's like the house has wheels and it's pretty unassuming and she's very
unimpressed. And a little bit of a dark history which gets revealed.
Correct.
Because they've come from California where, you know, it feels like they've had a fairly stable life and sort of they've brought up their children there up to that point, both of them working, sorting newly hatched chicks in terms of sex. So as they kind of, you know, kind of joke about it and sort of yell about it a couple of times, you know, just staring at chicken butts all day. And, of course, Jacob is trying to realize a dream of his and kind of fulfill something for his family that they haven't been able to do up to this point. So in some senses, it's a real kind of chamber piece with these, you know, family of five and the way that they interact and the scenes and scenes go by where we don't kind of interact with the wider world. But it is such an important kind of turning point for this family. You know, either they will fail or they'll succeed.
Yeah, and that's what it does so well. Like, you know, we've mentioned it's inspired by Lee Isaac Chung's own story, and he'll talk to that too. But, you know, it doesn't linger in that. It's not sentimental and it's not a memory piece. There's no voiceover about that one summer kind of thing. You do manage to walk in the footsteps of everyone in this family. Like, it's largely the father's story and David's. But the role of the mum, like Monica, in the wrong hands, she could just be awful. Like she might, it could be just frowny.
Fall into a stereotype.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But we do understand, we take time to understand, you know, she's cut off from everyone she knows at the start and she's desperate to make things work as well.
And very motivated to protect her child because David does have a heart condition.
Yeah, that's all part of the story. Like, and I love the way this film was put together, like just the cinema language of it all and the, you know, just everyone, there's risk for everything. Like David can't run because of his heart and like they're just risking everything by moving here to try and set up. And I just love that it's the story of migration, you know, like just is it worth the risk of packing up your family, starting somewhere fresh. Yeah, so much to relate to in this. And also the way they do interact with the community, like there's a church element that they try and engage with the community through the church. But it's everyone else who's the other. Like the white people are like the freaky, they've got their weird practices and, you know, kids say weird things. You're just nervous about what people are going to say to them because like they're the other in this. And, yeah, it's just a wonderful way to spend time with just a great story. I love it so much.
Yeah, no, it's very beautifully and acutely observed. And I think that it's very specific to this family's experience. And obviously that's very interesting learning about the basis in the director's own experience, life story. But it's imminently relatable for that specificity. And, you know, you easily could transplant that same story to Australia. You know, we sort of get most of it takes place, you know, using the Korean language in subtitles. Mm. And like you say, sort of the America is kind of, you know, the other outside the little bubble that the family has created for themselves. And I think for, you know, migrants kind of anywhere, I guess, who are sort of have a separation of language and, you know, trying to kind of create a new life for themselves, I think it really speaks to that experience.
Yeah. Well, even for me, like, you know, my grandparents came out from Scotland, brought six kids over from freezing cold Scotland to the middle of the outback in the 50s, I guess. You know, like there's so many ways to come into this and they didn't even have the barrier of language. Yeah, it just sets up that reality so well. And with a lot of unspoken acting as well. Like there are some very funny lines, but there are some equally impactful, hilarious looks that happen in this, but also really tragic in a way. Ones like that. There's one scene, I won't spoil it, but the camera just lingers on Steven Yeun's face, and it's the whole movie in one scene where it just lingers, and yeah, gorgeous.
Well, we clearly loved it. I think that it's about time now that we should hear from the writer-director as it's his story.
Yeah, sure. I mean, he should get a word in, I suppose, too.
I'm Lee Isaac Chung. So, let's have a listen.
Lovely to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you for doing this.
No, I loved your film. I've seen it twice now.
Oh, wow. Unabashed
fan. Yeah, no, absolutely gorgeous. Look, I'd love to start, given, you know, you're connected to this story, how did you balance, you know, wanting to be true to your experience and your family's, your parents' particular experience with, you know, telling a broader story? How did you balance that in the writing of it?
There was a lot of work in that. I think first I started off with the personal experiences. That was the base. So I had a list of memories. I had about like 80 that I had at the start, and that was the exercise that started the writing. And then I started to separate each of those memories according to character. So, you know, this memory seemed like it fit with YJ, I mean, with Sunja, the grandmother. This would fit with Monica, the mother. And I kind of listed that out. And from there, I realized I needed to really invest in this story as its own fictional story and to take it away from my memories to make it work as a story. And so I shifted memories around. I changed different things and slowly just tried to make it work as its own thing, something that would work even if people don't know that it's based on true life. That was kind of the hope that I had in the writing.
And in the casting, I mean, how did you take a similar approach? Like, you know, did you choose people who look like your parents or you know, more have the essence of your mum and dad or just great actors that you did? How did you?
I just went for great actors, to be honest. That was my number one. I want to work with the best. And that's who these people all were for me. They're the best. And they don't really look that much like my parents or my grandmother. Alan, the boy, is much cuter than I was. So I just went for, you know, the people who are most charismatic and the people who we would want to spend the most time with and people that we would fall in love with. That was a big thing for me because I wanted everyone to be rooting for this family and the survival of this family.
Yeah.
So I even told them, don't imitate my parents, don't imitate my family members. And I didn't even let them see pictures because I wanted them to have the freedom to do this their own way.
Yeah. And I read somewhere, is Stephen related to you by marriage? Is that true?
He is. Yeah. He and my cousin are married.
Yeah. Right. Is that the connection, or did you also just maybe not use that family connection to send the script his way? Was that a factor in casting him?
Yeah. So I've known Stephen for a while because of the marital relationship, but we didn't know each other very well. And I've always thought, I'm not going to send him anything. That was just internally, like, that would be so awkward. And then if he doesn't want to do it, you know, I'm a human being, I'll feel rejected. And I would kind of look at him at family reunions and think, look at this guy, he thinks he's better than me. You know, no, I'm just joking. But yeah, but I did want to have like a respectful distance with him professionally. And our agent actually said to me that she thinks that this is a perfect alignment for us, because he had also mentioned that he wanted to do something that's more of a personal story and stuff like that. So she had seen my script and she finally said, you guys need to talk about this. And she set up a call between us, and I was so flattered by Stephen, because first of all, he said, I want to help you make this movie. And he told me, I'm interested in being in this movie too, but if you think that's bad for this movie, then I won't do it. I just want to help you make it. And I took some time and I rewrote the script with him in mind, and it just dawned on me, no, you're perfect for this film, you know, and you would be incredible in this role. And once that was established, I mean, it was really a partnership that has been so life-giving and so fun for both of us. I feel like we're kind of like brothers now, just what we've gone through with this whole journey.
I mean, how could it be bad that he was in it, honestly?
I know, right? Now I look back and yeah. Mm. But there's an Asian American shyness or something, too much politeness there that was going on.
Sure. Just his role, and I guess the way his career is, you know, plotting out, you know, off Burning and Okja as well before it. Just the traits that he brings, can you speak to that, kind of like how the nonverbal stuff? I mean, it works across everyone in this film, but particularly just the looks are kind of just where it hits. How did you work with him to build up this really complex character?
With him, I gave him just a lot of freedom. I told him, I trust him. I trust you. Please just do your work as an artist, because I just trust him. I let him take the script as a blank canvas. I don't tend to write emotions into the scripts, because I like for actors to take that and interpret, and that work on set, I feel, is just really the beauty of making a film. So I noticed with him that he would perform things in such a subtle way and express so much with his face and gestures that in our editing, we could take out a lot of dialogue that he would say. For instance, there was a moment where he would talk about why he decided to leave California and move to Arkansas and get a farm, what was motivating him. Then we had dialogue of him talking about how much he hated chicken sexing. But we found that you add that stuff in, it's just superfluous to his performance, because he's just embodying that and expressing it. So I can't say enough about his work. He's so subtle and true. Like, everything he does is just true. And he brings that to the kids and everybody around him, all the other actors too.
Mm. And with Yeri playing Monica, you know, in the wrong mm-hmm. hands, that could be really a thankless role. She could be like the frowny,
sure. Yeah.
You know, buzzkill.
Exactly. <yeah. laughs>
But she's absolutely not. And it's so graceful, and you really shine light. You know, she doesn't have friends. She doesn't have family there until her mum arrives. Yeah, can you talk about just like, you know, we do relate to Jacob and to David, but equally just we do walk, finding ways for us to walk in everyone's footsteps. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the care you took to maybe lift up a character that might have otherwise been a sideline role.
Yeah, I remember with Monica, when we were in the script stage, I would get some notes back from people saying, she's just negative. She just is saying negative things. But to me, that would always floor me, because I never thought of her that way when I was writing or picturing her. I kind of come from a family of very quiet people, to be honest, where not much is said and so much is like in those moments. And when I met with Yeri, she totally got it. She totally understood what this character needs to be. She even worked with me in fleshing out certain things that needed to be there. For instance, she She told me, I just don't see any moment in which Monica is trying to bring fun to her kids in this story. And this is something that I feel Monica would be very much thinking about and wanting to do. And so the whole swing set scene was something that originated out of that dialogue with her. So it's that sort of work of mutually creating something with actors and, you know, seeing things in new ways that I just find so enlivening in the process. And same thing with Paul, Will Patton, he would do that. And yeah, Yunya Jung was also so great at, she's a superbly comic actress. She's so funny as an actress. And she had many suggestions on set that we would use to surprise Alan. For instance, her putting the chestnut in her mouth and offering it to him. That's something that she came up with, and we set it up so that Alan had no idea that she was going to do that. And it creates one of my favorite moments in the film.
Yeah, no, it's a great moment. And where did you find him? I mean, like you say, he's just cuteness personified, but
We found him through our casting director, Julia Kim. We put the hardest task on her. We asked her to find these two kids who are bilingual, Korean and English, of this specific age, and who are not actors, who are not trained actors, because we knew we were probably going to look for non-professionals for these two roles. So she did that in 6 weeks. That's the amount of time that she had. So it's a tribute to her work and also a lot of luck that these two kids answered the call and put in their audition. And from the start, we kind of knew that they were special, to be honest. You know, you just see him now and you can see that he's special, even in the trailer, you know.
Yeah, exactly. You know, this should not be unique at all, but you center the family's Koreanness in this community, and it's kind of, you know, it's the rest, everyone else who's the other. And, you know, like with the weird cross thing and, you know, like them in their ways.
Yeah.
How did you approach setting up that storyline and centering the family's Koreanness in this new location?
Yeah, I did feel from the start that I wanted the perspective to be within the families. And that was just true to our experience growing up, that outside of the home, that's where we saw foreigners. That's where we saw the foreign language being spoken, was outside of the home. And we were always trying to acculturate and try to figure out, who are these people? My sister and I, we watched tons of movies growing up, often like talking about, oh, this is how white people eat food, or, you know, things that we're trying to figure out. So I just remember that perspective on things and wanted to start with that perspective with this film. So it's not a perspective of us as Westerners trying to help this family along and become one of us, but instead it's really within this family as they really try to define themselves and figure out each other most of all. That was the most important thing within this story, the internal dynamics, internal story. Mm. And all the outside world is almost a texture to that. It creates isolation, creates loneliness. So I thought those elements of the story were more interesting to the drama of what's going on inside.
And did you take care with, you know, how everything can be interpreted, with things coming across as a statement, or, you know, like, were you conscious of that in the way you'd frame scenes and characters?
I'm honestly hoping to be politically a bit, what's the word here? Not aligned here when it comes to red state versus blue state, because we have so much of that here in the U.S. And my interest is in kind of cutting across those categories and framing a new discussion on what it means to be just a human, a family member, and finding ways to connect with each other. So to me, those are my politics with this. And that's kind of what I was trying to get across with it. I certainly am not criticizing red states. That was a big concern that I had going in. Just because, you know, I live in LA, and this is sort of the mindset that I'm often in where I live. And at the same time, I grew up in a very much a red state. Mm. And a lot of my friends are Republicans or very conservative. And we might disagree, but still there's much more that creates our friendship and creates bonds between us than political views, you know, these silly political arguments that we're having. So I've been so hesitant to even talk about Trump and all these things, because I want this film to be for everybody. I don't want it to just be for blue state people, or, you know, say that this is like against Trump. It's really more for things than against things is what I'm hoping.
Mm. And I'd love to talk just about the cinema language. I've got so many questions about that and the way you've made this film. It's very nondescript mobile home, you know, in kind of 70s, 80s mm-hmm. brown. Yeah. But you shoot it in such a beautiful way, and like it's such warmth and, you know, brown's amber. I just like the way that the reverential way you shoot the film, just the beauty of it. Can we talk about the look you wanted for it? It's a very long way to ask that.
Oh, no, that I'm so glad you're asking that, because I can talk about my favorite people on set. Because Lachlan Milne, who is a fellow Australian, was our cinematographer, and our production designer was Yong-Ok Lee. And we had an amazing lighting technician named Steve Mathis as well. They really created this elegant look, and this was what we were going for from the start. We were always talking about trying to make this family feel like they are existing in a different time, and to try to create a timeless feeling with it, almost like a fable or like a classic Hollywood story or something like that. So we always wanted to set it apart from maybe the aesthetics that we might be seeing a lot in these types of stories, and to invest it more with the feeling of a dream and fable. So those were the words that would often bounce around on set. And those guys, Lockie, Yong-Ok, Steve, they were mavens. They're just wizards. I don't know how to describe how they could pull off exactly what I'm thinking and feeling. And I just owe it all to them, that look.
Well, yes, thank you, Isaac. No, I know you're a busy man today. Thank you so much, and congratulations on the film.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Yeah, thanks so much.
So that was Lee Isaac Chung, the writer-director of Minari, which comes out in Australian cinemas on February 18th. And as you know, Fee and I both loved it, and we definitely recommend you go out and see it.
Mm.
I really liked that anecdote about how the actress who played the mother, Monica, worked the swing into the storyline.
Yeah, it's such good feedback. Like, you know, he probably didn't think to have a moment where she showed how invested she was in trying to make the kids, have a happy time. But, because you see, she's... You need to send the film. But, yeah, you see her working with a plank of wood and you're thinking, well, what is she doing there? But anyway, it becomes a nice moment. She builds a little swing for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Beautiful film.
Yes.
And so that leads us to back to awards. We kind of strayed from awards to chat about the film. What do you think its chances are? And sort of do you have a read on kind of, I guess, where the money's going right now?
Well, I mean... People may be aware of this because of how unfair this is. I didn't want to bring it up with him in the interview because I didn't want him to talk about something negative about his film, because there were so many other great things to talk about. But Minari is only in the Golden Globes as a foreign language film, not as an American film, not as a best film contender, etc., which I think is stupid because it's based on a rule that films need to be at least 50% in English. Mm. But this film is entirely... an American film. Like, it's literally about the American dream and the experience. So that's stupid. He also should be up for director awards and, should have so much more. But that said, there's a lot of Screen Actors Guild awards coming its way. I have no doubt that it'll be in contention for, you know, Producers Guild and directors and all of those coming down the pipe. Ideally Oscars too, because it's, I don't know what else a film needs to do to be considered. It's a very American film. Mm. But it's a pretty packed, field this year. Like, I've already on the record for my love for One Night in Miami. But, yeah they're all great films. But they're up against some that aren't. So all I'm going for are the ones I love.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, Oscar's not until April this year, so everything's kind of been the awards calendar is a mess, let's face it.
It is. Yeah, I know. I was thinking we don't want to peak too soon talking about awards season. I mean, we're in for a long haul because nominations don't come out until mid-March.
Yeah.
And then the event themselves are 25th of April in Australia. Yeah. So there's probably a few films we'll be talking about a little
stay
bit.
Stay tuned.
Yeah. You know, go watch everything. Space. Go watch them so that you know what we're talking about. And go watch Minari twice because it's better on the second watch. It's gorgeous. Cried a little bit more. yeah.
Well, that's great. I feel like we've covered a lot. For a first show, for a first time, you know, back in the saddle after after a little break. And so all I can say is go out there and subscribe to SBS The Playlist wherever you get your podcasts and give us a lot of stars and leave us a nice review because it helps people to find the show. And let us know what you thought of the movies and TV shows we discussed and what were you watching over summer on Facebook or Twitter at SBS Movies. And I'm on Twitter at Ben Nguyen TV.
And I'm on Twitter at Anything But Fifi.
And The Playlist is produced by Jeremy Wilmot, who joins us from the other side of a glass screen.
Because this is 2021 and we have to do things this way. So, hi, Jeremy.
Hi. Until next time.
Stay well and thanks for listening.